At the end of it, it was a sort of slanging match of bums, but that won't happen because we've got the right practitioners anyway. Without further ado, I'd like to keep this as informal as possible and give as many people an opportunity to speak and to make their views known. I'd like to start really by going back to turning off the thing, which
to the right.
Ivan, it's my I want my
it might
presentation.
Be one of the ones that's open if you click on the five at the bottom.
Yes.
In the start bar. Pagan.
Top.
Sorry.
Okay, I just would like to begin by returning to some.
It will come.
To these key questions that may now be completely irrelevant. But it would be quite a good idea, I think, just to sort of think about those for a moment. I'm not going to go through them again, but just to sort of leave them on the board and perhaps sort of refer to them at some point during the discussion. I'd like to start really by asking each of our practitioners to introduce themselves and to say a little bit about what they bring to the table, as it were, and then I would like to, I'll sort of throw out some questions and some comments and generally chair the discussion. So, Jan, would you like to take the floor, introduce yourself? And
My name is Jan Haverkamp. I started working in Central Europe in 1986 in Eastern Germany, the DDR. That was over the churches. The Protestant churches in the DDR gave space for people to organize around environmental issues. There were about 120 environmental groups in the GDR. The smallest 4 or 5 people, the biggest 180, that was in Dresden. And I traveled around them, networked between them, and shared experiences from the Dutch environmental movement with them in order to create environmental activism under the circumstances of the socialist DDR, which was a very interesting time. We went through the revolution there together, more or less. I mean, if you it was 3 weeks there, 6 weeks waiting for a new visa, 3 weeks there. That's the way, the rhythm that got into it. Through the revolution up till 1991, 1992. Then I worked for 1 year in Czechoslovakia. There was a stroke between the two words, Czechoslovakia at that time, and a year later it was two countries. In 1993 to 1995, I worked 2 years in Romania, then 2 years in Ukraine, in between some stints in Albania, Croatia, amongst others, trying to restart the environmental movement in Croatia at the end of the war. It was still war, but there was still a lot, or there was enough interest already to move away from only peace themes towards environmental themes. And then I emigrated to the Czech Republic. The work I did until 1997 was for a Dutch foundation called Milieucontact Oost-Europa, environmental contacts with Eastern Europe. There was an organization was set up by the entire Dutch environmental movement, and that's a big one. In the Netherlands, 1 in 4 people is a member of an environmental or nature protection organization. 1 in 4. That's a lot. And those organizations made that foundation with funding from the environmental ministry, and we facilitated the cooperation between all these Dutch environmental groups and the upcoming environmental movement in Central Europe. So that was why I was in Romania, Albania, Croatia, and Ukraine. Then I emigrated to the Czech Republic, worked a short while for NGO computer networks, the introduction of internet, strategic use of internet. And then I started working for Greenpeace in the Czech Republic, having been volunteer already since 1980, so it's a long time ago. But also on a paid basis as energy campaigner, campaign director, then the nuclear campaigner for all of Central Europe. And now I'm working since 4 years in Brussels for the EU unit, also on mainly on nuclear power, bit on coal, and energy policy, and still a bit of a focus on Central Eastern Europe.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Ben.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ben Rattenbury. I work for Euclid Network. Unfortunately, I don't have the depth of experience as Jan. I was in primary school when the Berlin Wall came down. But I can hopefully nonetheless still contribute. I've been working in the Balkans now almost 5 years. And Euclid Network is the European network of civil society leaders. So what we do is connect and support joint projects between civil society leaders and senior managers across the wider Europe, so EU, European neighbourhood, Eastern and Southern, and with a big focus on the Western Balkans. We also advise the European Commission on some of their civil society development strategies in the region, so working with what was DG Enlargement and now still calls itself that, even though it's the External Action Service. And we also work a lot...
Still
the Commission?
DG Enlargement is still the Commission.
Okay, I stand corrected. And we are working with partners in the region to develop civil society development projects as well as democratisation projects, and working with EU delegations and the British embassies, amongst other embassies as well.
Thank you.
I am still Anne Burrell, working for the European Commission, and I have a much less interesting background, I think, than some of others, but I've been in my present unit now for almost 10 years. I entered originally as a desk officer for Romania, and at that time I also covered Moldova, so I participated in things like writing the letter for our commissioner about Russia Montana. I became deputy head of unit in 2004, and that is still my post now. Our unit has expanded, so we now in fact cover all bilateral relations globally, but still I tend to focus my activities more on the enlargement countries and the neighborhood zone. I just would like to say, perhaps in answer to one of the questions which has been going around, can the environmental perspective inform our understanding of Europe? Pianization. And I understand there may be lots of ways to look at that question, but I would say overall the answer should be yes, because environment is something that cuts across the activities of our citizens. It's something that's very closely related to governance. You can't improve your environment without making sure that you have some fundamental governance mechanisms in place. You need some democracy, you need some public participation, you need access to information, and these are fundamental elements of state building, and it's part of why the environmental NGOs in Central Europe were a key actor back at the time when the Berlin Wall came down. So to me, yes, environment is very much an integral part of, and in a certain way a proxy for, state building in these countries, Europeanization in general.
Thank you. I think the obvious place to start really is this issue of lessons learned and what are the lessons from your perspectives that can and should and perhaps will inform development of non-state actors and environmental governance in the countries that we have been looking at in the last session and throughout, really referring to throughout the day. In other words, what if we want to sort of say, I think we know from the kind of scholarly work, and we know often from a kind of rather a narrow perspective of what is this legacy of Central Eastern Europe, what actually happened. But I think we very rarely now go back to that with any kind of serious critical eye, particularly as a sort of in a kind of post-accession period. I'd like to sort of start really with that. What can be learned? What is the legacy from your perspectives?
That's a very difficult question, because if I can't help but also look at Western Europe at that moment. And when I listened to the discussion that we had today, and we talked a lot about civil initiative, the first thing that struck me was, if I look at civil initiative in the Netherlands or in Germany or in the UK, the first civil initiative was very often inspired also by things that happened outside of the country, by models outside of the country, movements outside of the country, and the fact that we talk about, when we talk about Czech Republic or we talk about Serbia, that people from outside help motivating is nothing bad. But having said that, every country has its own background. And for me, one of the key experiences has been to acknowledge that every country needs its own time. When I was working for Milieucontact, the Dutch Environmental Ministry always gave me first 6 months without agenda to be in a country, repair fax machines and be in offices and sleep on the floor and things like that, but just to slowly start swimming in that society and only then do a needs assessment and then work for 2 years. And everybody said that's a luxury. And the Germans always came in for 3 days and then were out again. And I think that the ministry was right in granting that time, because it's not a luxury. Every country is very different. And within countries, you've got very much different. Let me give you one example to close with. If I look at the Belene campaign, the No to Belene campaign in Bulgaria, what kind of citizens' activity do you see there? Well, Belene is very much in the north of the country, on the border with Romania, directly on the Danube, next to the Peshtin Nature Reserve, where you also had the infamous Belene Gulag, the Belene prison, where the Bulgarian government, former one, puts their political prisoners. It's very far away from Sofia. Now, still we do see their opposition against that nuclear power station. And what kind of people are in that kind of opposition? Which people speak out? Well, first of all, you've got the academic town Svishtov, 40 kilometers away, 30 kilometers away. Academics, students, high education level, a total town against, including municipal hall. The municipal council has passed one after another a resolution against the power station, and they still speak out. Every year there is a Chernobyl commemoration, etc. That is a community. So there's community feeling, people speak out. Nikopol on the other side, there's one woman who stands up already since 1987 against the project. And she killed it once, and then came back, and she's still active. In 2005, I needed to organize 9 months of bodyguard protection for her, because she got death threats. 1 month I was bodyguard for myself. And strangely enough, the present Prime Minister, Boyko Borisov, was at that time head of the police, and he guaranteed safety for us. We had a telephone call when we came once out of Sofia. She was cold and then suddenly became very meek. I said yes, and said yes, and said sorry, yes. And then I said, well, it was Boyko Borisov. Boyko Borisov? Yeah, he said he knew that we were driving there. He had already informed the next police districts, etc., etc. And whether I could next time inform the police as we had agreed. And I said yes, I would. Okay. So that situation, yeah. And she is strong, one strong woman who carries them around her, a group of people. That's another group. And then you've got Sofia with capital, which means also capital, which means also a bit more money.
Can I just sort of see if there's anybody, just want to hear some views as well in the audience about anything that anyone want to come in with this, to comment from their own perspectives in terms of lessons learned and yes, Indranil, yes?
Just sort of two general questions maybe for all the panelists. One is, what we've spoken a lot at various points about projectization, why that's a bad thing, and you know that maybe the strategies that have been done before wasn't the best way to develop capacities either at the state or non-state level. Have any lessons been learned either amongst larger NGOs based in Brussels or amongst the Commission? The second thing I'd ask for more specifically of the larger NGOs, if there's this Green 10 group of NGOs based in Brussels, and there's a paper that was written a few years ago about how they were very important in driving capacity building in Central and Eastern Europe. What kind of lessons are learned? Is that same strategy being put in place in the Western Balkans? If so, why not one?
Ben, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. Well, I don't know too much about the G10, so I'll just answer in more general terms. A lesson that I hope is being learnt by the Commission at the moment is that you need to consult proactively in the region. Because we've been involved in advising a thing called the Civil Society Facility, which is DG Enlargement's major policy for strengthening civil society across the Western Balkans. And it's actually a very bold approach that they've taken this one. It's a very big budget, covering all the countries with a similar approach, and it's really something radical for the Commission. And I know very well the official who's implementing this, who's very interested in not just following bureaucratic procedures, but actually delivering impact. So, very refreshing guy to work with. The problem is that the whole approach wasn't really gone through in the region. So, people in the region are actually very resentful of what's happening, even though it has its merits. It hasn't been perfectly implemented, but it hasn't been a complete failure either. But if you speak to people in the region, they will describe it as a complete failure. I think partly that's pride, because there's a sense that they've had enough of being talked down to, and actually there's a lot of expertise there which isn't being recognised. And partly it's the sense that it's been imposed from the outside. So, as I said, I hope this is a lesson being learned currently, which is that engagement and consultation in the region has to be substantive, and it has to actually change policy. It has to be shown to have an impact. Otherwise, there's just not going to be the buy-in in the region that's essential for anything to work, no matter how good the ideas are.
Yeah, okay. Well, sort of related perhaps to the projectization problems, I think one of the things we've learned and we're probably already aware of in 2004 and trying to tackle but haven't yet completely mastered is the need really to have a kind of strategic approach, both within the countries and in the donor community, the Commission. There's lots of goodwill, there's lots of people who want to get things done. But we've seen very often you sort of have people working at cross purposes. And so certainly within the countries, we've been trying to push the countries to set out their priorities, to see what the first things are they need to do and where they move on from there. We've also been trying to encourage, for instance, the IFIs to work together, the donors to work together. We're in a period of limited resources, and we really think that we can be more efficient if we agree between ourselves which direction we're supposed to be going and that we're all singing off the same song sheet. Stability of institutions I wanted to refer to, and I take the point that was made this morning that stability in and of itself is not necessarily the key objective, but we saw, I can refer to Romania because it was the country in the last wave that I knew the best. The ministry changed its structure several times. Every time, you know, the minister sneezed, he or she had a new idea of how to restructure things. And they kept coming to us and say, oh, we've looked at such and such a country and we see that they have the agency separately, or they have the inspector here, and they kept changing. We finally said to them, you know, you want to make some progress, stop changing. Your system's not ideal, no system's ideal, but you know, just settle down and move ahead. Even if you don't have ideal institutions, it's better to have reasonably good institutions and stability that people can actually work in. But those are both kind of more institutional issues. I think that probably the key factors are more some of these sort of cultural and psychological factors, and certainly one of them is the importance of building ownership and building a confidence in both the ministry and in the NGOs, that they really do have a role to play. And we certainly saw in the Central European countries, and I think it's very similar, if perhaps not stronger, in some of the Southeast European countries, a sort of a learned helplessness and sitting and waiting for somebody to come in and solve your problems. Well, somebody may come and help you solve your problems, but they're not going to really be solved until there's an ownership and an interest inside the country itself. And we can give all the technical assistance in the world, external NGOs can come in, but if there isn't an endogenous movement to change things, a belief that you can change things, I don't think it's going to happen. Now, how you stimulate that is another question I don't have the answer to. And finally, I would just say that one of the keys, I mean, we all know that environment is not considered the top priority of many governments, if any governments in the world. Montenegro claims in its constitution it's an ecological state, but I don't think we don't take that too literally. But it certainly is not the top priority of governments. But we need to raise it up the priority level so that the ministries of environment get proper financing, get proper resources, so that the people in the ministries of economy and regional planning understand why it is of interest to them to make sure that natural resources are being used efficiently, that good decisions are being made about developments. And this is something where I think the international community, including the Commission, does have a role. And we did do studies. I mean, everybody talks about the costs of compliance with the environmental acquis, and the costs are very high for the EU 12 plus Turkey. We estimated that the costs of breaching compliance were about €1,000 per citizen. I would expect that in some of the Balkan countries the cost is probably even higher. We don't have the figures. But what people don't talk about as much is what the benefits are. And we did do studies trying to quantify the benefits. And, you know, it's a bit of a picking a number out of a hat, but we certainly got an estimate looking at some of the health benefits, particularly from air legislation, but also looking at some of the more indirect benefits from nature, from water legislation. And I think that this kind of information needs to be better diffused. We tried to diffuse it, but our diffusion routes are limited. But one of the ways of building up an ownership in the country is feeling you have the capacity to do things, but the other is feeling you want to do things. And you're not going to do things if you don't think you have there's a benefit from it. So I think we need to articulate better the benefits of what these countries do, particularly in Southeast Europe, where it's so far off in the future that if there's not a perception of self-interest, the carrot of EU accession is so far off that it's not a great motivator for some of the countries. There has to be a feeling that these are changes we want to make that are going to benefit our citizens, regardless of whether or not one day we're going to be entering the EU.
Can I just pick up on that? I know Ben wants to answer me, but I think that what came across very strongly in this morning's the first and second panels, really, is the extent to which this issue of uncertainty and a kind of weak membership perspective is perhaps something that we have overlooked. And it's also something that I remember listening to Heather Grebe talking about the fact that for Central Eastern Europe, membership was never really more than two years. There was always a sort of sense in which in two years' time, okay, it might have been a moving target, but there was this sense of thing. And, you know, clearly, that is not the case in any of the countries that we've looked at and talk about in the region. And perhaps we are just overlooking that too much. Maybe that is the critical point. Maybe that is the thing that's absolutely what separates this group of countries and their Europeanisation from what's gone before.
I'm not really agreeing with that. If I look, for instance, at Romania, exactly at Romania, where we've seen that one of the big driving forces was indeed the accession to the European Union. One of the reasons that the NGO community did not develop so far is because that was the driving factor and not the will of people to work on their environment. That came on cases. Rosia Montana is one of them, where people then really stood up, organized themselves, got input from outside, and then the acquis started living. Yeah, then there was a reason to implement, to take the laws as they were and take them over. The activity doesn't come with your perspective for accession. But there's one name I've not heard here the whole day, and I'm very surprised about it, and that's the name of the Regional Environmental Center. Yes, it was built up in the 1990s. Yes, and it has been functioning and doing exactly that, what we're talking about. Capacity building, support for civil society, for business society to get active, implementation of the acquis in PRI. And that also in the Western Balkans. And they're still there. Now, we can learn lessons from them. I mean, they've definitely not been perfect. But when something
I can see some nodding heads in the audience there, and just sort of, maybe it's a good point. Does anybody want to say about REC?
Point is the G10. Yeah, you mentioned G10, and then you talk about capacity building. Well, Yes, G10. Did you G10? Everybody knows what the G10 is? It's the Green 10, the big 10 environmental organizations that have presence in Brussels. BirdLife, WWF, Greenpeace, EEB, Transport Environment, Food Bank Watch, FOE, Native Friends from Austria.
Heal,
and then I'm missing one. Doesn't really matter, but those organizations, they do not do specific capacity building plans. But what they do is they network. And I think one of the most effective ones is the one that we see the least in Brussels, which is CEE Bankwatch. Mm-hmm. Lost part of their funding this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I don't understand the commission in funding priorities, etc. But that is indeed a very effective network.
Let's hear, Ben, what do you want to, you also want to respond, Ben?
Well, actually, it's not so much on the environmental level. It's more coming back to one of Engineer's questions, which is about the projectization. And just on a very basic level, considering that the European Union is by far the biggest donor now for civil society in the region, one very good way to encourage projectization of the sector is to only offer project funding. Now, there is a very small but increasing amount of funding that's available as core financing for civil society in the region. But that's only for some selected countries and in very selected areas, which many NGOs have never even heard of, actually, so they don't even know that they can apply for it. But a real problem is that it's not only just project funding, but it's generally short-term project funding. You're looking at 2 years max, if you're lucky. So when we speak to our partners in the Balkans about, you know, what's your five-year plan, and they say, well, we don't even have a one-year plan because things change so quickly, it's partly because the project cycle is so short. And actually, one of the most progressive donors that I've worked with, CEDA, Swedish CEDA, have cottoned onto this. And so, for example, in Ukraine now, they're experimenting with offering core funding to a handful of NGOs to let them really develop their institutional capacity and move beyond this project cycle.
Yeah, yeah, maybe just two points on NGOs. Well, first, yes, I mean, there is core funding for EU NGOs. There's a bit of a problem with that now because the present legal base doesn't cover activities outside of the EU. This was a casualty from the discussions on the financial perspective that started 2007, and it's something that we're actively going to try to correct for the next financial perspective after 2013. But there's an interesting thing about the development of the NGOs, and it relates kind of to the civil society forum. We have our own environment forum, which I mentioned before. It's an activity where we work with a consultant. We put out a terms of, not reference, but put out criteria and asked NGOs in the region to express an interest to participate, and according to those criteria, we selected two or three NGOs from each country. And we're giving them information about the EU, we're having them network between themselves, and at one point we were approached by one of the big NGOs in Brussels who said, could they come along and participate in this group? And we thought, well, that's a really good idea, because in the past we've set up twinning between the big NGOs in Europe and individual NGOs. But we said, you know, we want to make sure that this is what the participating NGOs are interested in. So we went to the next meeting of the forum, and we asked them, and the NGOs in the Southeast Europe region said no. They said, we don't want the big NGOs from Brussels coming into the meeting, because they were afraid if they came in, it would change the whole dynamic, and that they were going to be kind of the little brothers, that the attention was all going to go via the international NGOs. So I think there's an interesting dynamic there, and I think on the one hand, the local NGOs have an awful lot to learn from the European NGOs, but they're also very sensitive to not being talked down to. And perhaps this is what is seen through this issue about how the civil society forum is perceived also, because what we're doing is actually separate from the civil society forum, and there's been some criticism that it's not better integrated, and Henk and I are talking about how to try to improve that, but there is this tension.
That sounds a very good point at which to open out into the comments from the floor, because I think it's something that I certainly spend quite a lot of time thinking about this role of when these big networks roll in and what the impact is. Mm-hmm. Miranda?
It's actually just an anecdotal experience also, but I was invited by a very small NGO in Croatia to help them out with thinking about environmental protection in the northern part of Croatia. And what struck me is that the difficulty with getting established there as a local NGO was the financing question, and how do you afford to put your time and effort into an NGO that otherwise can't pay you a salary unless you get the outside funding. And the what you were talking before about the project-based funding, that works as long as you have the project, but then you're always running and looking for the next project, and it appears not to be that easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some of the questions we were talking about before about the lack of an active civil society may also very much be tied to this question of how do you institutionalize something? You need the funding for it, you need the resources to make it possible for NGOs to get off the ground and survive. And of course, some have managed, but it does seem like a pretty difficult battle.
One of the responses to that was, for example, in Romania, to institute this tax allowance of 1%, where people could donate 1% of their tax towards the running of NGOs. But the outcome of that was that NGOs started to dedicate a lot of their personnel, which is anyway very, very small in numbers, to activities related to disseminating information about what they do, to printing leaflets, which is quite costly. So a lot of investment was necessary in order to be able to get a hold of that 1% of people's taxes. And their initial response was to go towards businesses first, which you know would require less effort, and then far more difficult to actually disseminate this information towards citizens. So for them, this you know activities have required a lot of investment in the first place in the change of their capacity and activities, and so it wasn't very productive in the first few years after this reform. These measures were introduced in early 2000. So still by the accession time, when I did my interviews in 2004-2005, they basically weren't able to tap into this resource yet, simply because they didn't have the capacity to do so, and it was very, very difficult for them to adapt.
But you point to a very important issue there, and that is that gave NGOs, and the first time was in Hungary, where it was 2%. That gave NGOs the possibility of getting domestic funding, separate from the project, because projects also require a lot of investment in getting your funding. And for most of the groups, I think it's also about the 40% that you're talking about. What I think is interesting there, and that is something that over the years I've tried to fight for, is also to get the idea in groups accepted that you can get local funding. And I think one of the things that really went wrong in Romania was the fact that until that rule came in, everybody was project oriented, which means was following the project cycles and the project priorities. So they were not setting their own priorities. And there was no time and also no capacity to go beyond that, to do your own thing, your own protest. Now I see my Mutuverde, for instance, or I see Regenerație, groups in Bucharest that are doing also spontaneous actions for which you normally spoken would not be able to do project funding or use project funding, which do not cost that much, but they cost time and they cost people, and they put it in, which I think is a renovation that gives a new dynamic. Greenpeace has gotten a special position in some countries. You said big ones come in, yeah? But Greenpeace was always very careful to come into new countries. When we first came into Hungary, we first had a talk with all the NGOs in Hungary about, okay, what do you think should be the niche? Do you want Greenpeace to come in? And if yes, what should be the niche? And then they said, well, you're going to do it. You can do these actions. So yes, we want you to come in, but there also needs to be coordination, etc. That's the situation we have now in Hungary. But the important part next to it is Greenpeace there started doing local fundraising from local people. Now also 2%, but before also just donors. And in Poland and in Hungary and in Czech Republic, we see that Greenpeace is financing a large part of its work itself, and it's taken over by some other NGOs. Nuti Duha is a good example in the Czech Republic. That is, I think, an important development, which we also have to see in the West Balkans at a certain moment. Serbians are poor, but they can pay 5 dinar a month, for instance, and a lot of 5 dinars, five times 5 dinars, are already 500. And then you can get at least a part of your work outside of that project cycle, because the project cycle is killing initiative.
Well, and this also picks up the sort of ownership aspect. And as I think one of the very important things to make a change is to have people feel that they actually have some ability to contribute and to do something. But I wanted to come back to the rec, which you brought up. Yeah, I mean, I think the executive director doesn't like it when I use this expression, but we have certainly seen the REC as a very effective tool for enlargement. They see their role as somewhat broader, but we have seen them as an institution which is historically not on a project basis. Now, having said that, we've got difficulties now, so we, the Commission, can't give them core funding. We can only give them project funding. But and they are an institution which has an ongoing program to help build the capacity of the different actors in the countries, and that would include the NGOs, that would include the local authorities, it would include also the government actors, and particularly part of their mandate is to build bridges between the different actors. And I don't know what experience those of you in the room have had, but our feeling has been that the REC has made a very big contribution in Central and Eastern Europe. To our way of thinking, they've sort of outgrown that region now, but there's still a lot of good work that they could do in Southeast Europe and in Turkey, which we haven't been talking about so much today, but which faces many of the same challenges.
Is it your view that that's what they could be doing and therefore are not necessarily doing? And if so, why?
They are doing, but they could do more. I think the office, my opinion is that the office in Turkey is functioning very well, has a few difficulties with their status there with the authorities. In the Balkan countries, their level of activity varies from one country to another, but I know that the REC is sometimes seen by NGOs as a competitor, but in our way of thinking, it's not a competitor. It fills a very unique niche that should be supporting all of the other actors, including the NGOs. And I would certainly argue that the actors in the country should be making use of what the REC can offer.
If I could just quickly, cheaply interject. Unfortunately for REC, I mean, I don't know much about the situation, but I've seen this happen in other fields. When they can no longer get core funding and they have to compete like everyone else with project funding, they immediately become a competitor. And the same has happened actually with UNDP across the region, is that they're now applying for project funding, they're winning it, and all the other NGOs resent them for it.
Yeah, okay, but you see, you said all the other NGOs. So this is the first point, that the REC is not and should not be functioning as an NGO, because they're an international organization that was established by, I don't know how many countries, 30 countries, 40 countries. But yes, you're completely right that when the REC had assured core finance, it was a lot easier for them to stick to their core mandate. And it's not only the NGOs that feel that they're a competitor, but the consultants. And I can only say it's unfortunate that they can't receive from the Commission core funding. It doesn't mean that they can't receive it from other donors, but we're not able to give them core funding.
Could I just
ask you a question? You dropped the word consultants here, and we have not talked about it also today. Is what is the role of consultants in all this? I have in my practice always, I mean, I've met some very good ones.
Could I put consultants on the list? Because there's something that I'm abusing my position as chair, but there's something that's niggling me, and it comes really out of the last panel, but I think I just want to explore it more, and it relates to something I said at the beginning, which is this, my rather kind of audacious claim that the environment is this effective lens, and it retains that currency even in areas of post-conflict and contested statehood, weak statehood. And I think one of the things that I got the sense of in the last panel, particularly when we're talking about Serbia, we're talking about the capacities, both financial capacities of citizens and their interest in the environment, the importance of the environment. I mean, certainly as a group of scholars in the room, I mean, surely we want to make a case to say, drawing on the experience of Central and Eastern Europe, that, you know, this wasn't, in the words of Václav Klaus all those years ago, it's not, the environment isn't the icing on the cake. You know, it's not something that is of low political significance. And I would say, and you know, by all means, knock me down for this, but actually, as a sort of mechanism of regulation, it's more critical that these countries put in place effective regulation, particularly as we heard from Miranda's paper this morning with regard to climate change, but also when the investment is in the energy sector, when there's a very different kind of model of political economy, that I'm sort of a bit worried about that we fall into this view that, look, there's just too many other problems, that the environment, you know, we know it's important, but it's not. Is that something that we can challenge and should challenge? And
well, this is.
Am I worried about something that I shouldn't be?
This is not just a problem in the enlargement or accession countries. And we're having the debate at the European scale, at the global scale, about how we should develop our.
But my point, I think. Sorry to go on, but when we did our work in Serbia, one of the things that struck me very much was how, in the absence of privatisation. Or in what we tend to think is kind of semi-murky kind of privatisations, where ultimately the state was still the owner of companies and things, that the kind of fear that there wasn't going to be the regulation, that environmental regulation was almost as it had been perhaps under late socialism, that it was not being implemented. That sort of fear, particularly when you've got Eastern investment and Russian investment and Turkish investment, where there isn't the same emphasis on conditionality and the emphasis on the environment, I feel that makes an even stronger case for the environment. Mm-hmm. Yes, sorry.
What I said before is related to the opinions of people.
Sure.
And there is a difference when the environment is the perceived regarding something aesthetic, like we want to have clean neighborhood, beautiful city, clean streets. It's something, a combination of one side aesthetic and the other side hygiene. It is one perception of the environment, and this is not important. It is less important for people. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, is this direct link to health, to personal health, and then environment or to say environmental hazards become important for people. But only in these places like Pancho and Bor, where you can breathe, you can feel in the air the smell of the substances which are harmful.
So it's a problem of framing. Claudio, do you want to hand up?
There's a trick that the green parties are using, especially now with the crisis, which is actually taking over the whole of the agenda. So basically what the EGP was doing, and also the member parties, was to change the paradigm. Because if you look at the environment, you just think, we have to pay a lot of money to protect whatever is there. So it costs us a lot of money to get a share, but it's not going to put money in our pockets. So if you frame environmental protection as something that it bears costs, of course, people, especially during economic crisis, they will tend to less care about the environment. So the Green parties are doing the same. The crisis and the protection of the environment, they are linked. And one of the ways to get out of the crisis is to kind of activate protection of the environment as an engine for investment, for job creation, and so. So I wouldn't say that is not contentious. I wouldn't say it's kind of isolated. And I think there is a big chance that environmental protection could be linked with what is arguably the most important policy item for the coming years in Europe and other countries.
Do you think, but that's very interesting, because do you think then that's not happening because of the weakness, not necessarily just of green parties, but of parties that are in the region that have taken up the green issue, as it were? Or is it something that just reflects weak civil society or weak NGOs? This change of framing?
I'm not sure. I think green parties are not the major parties. We're doing greenwashing, most of them. I mean, they're not willing. I mean, I doubt that they have like serious plans of economic recovery from the crisis, let alone something that is related to the environment. But this is a strategic move from the green parties, saying that so far green parties were regarded as economically, let's say, challenged. They didn't understand economics. So right now they're creating this challenge and say, look, we understand economics, and it makes sense economically to invest into the environment. So vote for us, because we'll take out
of the price. This comes back to what I said before about articulating the benefits. When I was talking about benefits, I wasn't just talking about benefits that are aesthetic. But if you talk about air legislation, you talk about health costs, and those are very real economic figures that can be attached to that. But beyond that, this whole discourse of linking environment and economy, you know, at the EU level, the EU 2020 initiative is a recast of the Lisbon Agenda. The Lisbon Agenda was purely economic. EU 2020 takes a slightly different slant on it. It incorporates the idea of resource efficiency. It's not quite the same as environmental protection, but it's headed in that direction. So I think it's a discourse that's happening not only, or is starting to happen not only in the candidate countries and potential candidates, but it's something that is being discussed in Europe. It's being discussed. OECD's put out a major document recently on green economy. So it's, yeah.
Miranda.
Sitting in these advisory bodies for the German government, that's all we talk about is the green economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me actually wonder, to what extent are the Balkan states and maybe also the new member states of the European community looking at all for alternative economic development models? I know the classic understanding is they're in the old model, and that's what they want to follow. But often you do find entrepreneurs in states that start pushing alternative visions and models. And I'm just kind of curious to what extent those voices are at all to be found. The idea that maybe you can do a different kind of economic development that might be more environmentally sensitive, perhaps also better for keeping jobs at home.
You're looking at me. I don't have the answer, but I mean it's certainly something that we discuss with them when we meet with them. But
I think the biggest thing, I will come back to your thing as well, because I think it was important what you said about people think about things with their health. But one of the problems I have with a lot of the talk within the European Union is also when we talk about economics, we talk in one line. We talk one line of thinking about this economic way, and then tomorrow we talk about that economic way. What is important is at a certain moment, and it happens, is that you start to compare alternatives. And one of the things that I'm trying to do now in environmental impact assessments and strategic environmental assessments is trying to get through that you have to first develop several policy alternatives and then compare those, and then you can choose what makes most sense for the environment, for you, for your jobs, for et cetera, et cetera. We can do that easily because we know that we will win then for a more renewable future because we've already done the calculations and that's the outcome. But it's very difficult to get there. First of all, you need to have a setup in which it is accepted that if you make an energy policy, that you do a strategic environmental assessment, and that in that strategic environmental assessment, you compare different scenarios. What we see now is we get an energy policy, which is the wish list of the largest utility, that is being pushed through. Then we get the nuclear power station on the table. Then we get an environmental impact assessment of the nuclear power station. I go to court and sue them for the fact that there's no alternatives in it. Then they say, yes, but they were in the, but we are following the energy strategy. Now, at the moment, I try to get through a court case far enough that we can, at the end at the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee with the same point, and the European Commission, where we say, well, you cannot point to that energy strategy because the energy strategy did not compare alternatives. So you will have to do it for your project. And they say, yes, but that's not real. So, okay, then next time,
when you first stop this for the time being until you do a proper environmental strategic environmental assessment for your energy policy, and then we can look further. The real thing that we need to get on the table is indeed proper energy policy development. And that's step one, strategy with SIA. Step two, sectoral strategy with SIA. Step three, project. And that project environmental impact assessment has to contain all the data for the justification of the impact you're going to make.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now just following the Aarhus Convention.
Yeah.
And the Aarhus Convention gives us as citizens the possibility to take that to court. Now, that is where I see citizens standing up. I want to go back to you for the health, because that's an important point. If I look now at where local NGOs make image and get support, it is toxic catastrophe. Yeah, look at Hungary recently, look at Payamare, look at Rosia Montana. Toxic issues are indeed the issues that draw the most attention. They're very sexy. They're not driving policies on the larger scale very much, but they draw a lot of attention. So what I see is, although toxics is not a priority issue for Greenpeace office in Hungary is working on toxics. The Greenpeace office in Slovakia is working on old pesticides, leftovers, and they come with the sheds where there's a lot of... Yes. But what is more important then is getting on that basis, because somebody here talked about Stephanie from in Rosia Montana, getting people in the environmental impact assessment. Yes, getting them people into those kind of procedures where they indeed also take their rights. And that needs inspiration. That does not need us as biggies from the outside, but it needs somebody who points out, you've got the right. And then the local people say, yes, but we don't do it in our country.
Okay.
And then you say, no, the Aarhus Convention is law in your country, standing law.
And let's take some, any comments? Anybody like to comment on this? Yes, please. Yes.
That the people in Serbia, for instance, would hardly buy the green economy except if it is a newly established branch like organic food. That would be a new niche in the market. That's okay, but people perceive that we are a country that is to be re-industrialized. So, green economy is...
It depends what you understand by green economy, and I think...
I mean, it would improve standards of industrial production, however, in comparison to the previous time, of course. But
the idea of green economy is developing an economic model that looks over a longer time frame, that perhaps over a short time frame, just promoting the existing industry seems to be the most economically interesting. But in fact, if you reconstruct the economic system and look at the whole chain of inputs, the chain of outputs, how you're using products in industry, you can construct an economy which has the same economic advantage, has the same output, but which is more respectful of the environment.
But it's interesting in Miranda's paper this morning.
Yeah.
Is, I suppose it begs the question, to what extent does Europeanization facilitate that, and does it enable that? I mean, the most interesting of all of your things was the electricity or the energy map with all these arrows that you realize actually... you know, I just think it's this idea that we to what extent does this dominant agenda of Europeanization actually almost dominate the kind of discourse and the policy without actually allowing for those kind of bigger discussions and thinking? I don't know.
I was thinking about the perception. Mm-hmm. So if you expect reindustrialization, you do not expect it to be greeny in the coming years, you know, and again connected with the level of unemployment, so people expect the employment,
yeah.
Not to...
But that's why we need to... Miranda's
results, that we're expecting increasing pollution, for instance, and then, or increasing the bad results in years after the accession, but in some countries, as I remember, that was not the case, so...
This is why, though, there's a need to engage with the ministries of economy, the ministries of development, to help them look at, and here I think I come back to what you're saying, look at the different options
yeah.
that they're facing, And certainly the EU is not going into any of these countries saying, do not develop your economies. I mean, that's not what the EU wants.
But what the EU should have insisted until now for developing alternative scenarios. Because it was not the case all the time.
Nobody does it. No,
even the questions.
Can I come back? You're asking, is Europeanization helping this? I think we have to realize that this is still something that the EU doesn't do as well as we should. And it's something that I'm personally hopeful that the outcome of our economic crisis, global economic crisis over recent years, combined with the problems of climate change, which people are more aware of, that we'll be going through this transition inside the EU. The question is whether we can bring along the applicant countries and the potential candidates at the same time.
I've got a long list building up here. Stop with Liliana.
I want to raise the issue though, what kind of incentives can push the economy, including industrialization. I mean, when people and organizations talk about the green economy, they don't exclude industrialization, but a different kind of industrialization, more efficient, using inputs more effectively. And this is very popular talk now in Geneva, too. All the international organizations that have anything to do with the environment love the term. But I have a real problem with this term, the green economy. That nobody really is suggesting the instruments by which this green economy would be achieved across vastly different societies. And so when we talk about Europeanization, one of the key questions for research is what kind of instruments have been successful incentives for greening of the economy, and what kind of instruments are available out there. So maybe some kind of strategic thinking at the European level. The Renewable Energy Directive was one thing that was very effective. It's not the most efficient regulatory instrument, but it was very effective in providing incentives to do this kind of investment. So what else do we have in the European policy spectrum that provides differential incentives for green development?
Let's just gather another couple of comments on that. Ivan?
I was going to make a quick comment, anecdotal comment, about people's desires. A lot has been said about people's desires or expectations. But actually, I'd like to turn that into a question. Do you think that what we're dealing with is actually an issue of a sort of awareness deficit? People in the West, we hear most of us, have been bombarded since a very early age by messages about the environment. The environment has been an issue in our lives since, at least in my life, since primary school. I just don't think that's the case with people in the region, certainly not in Serbia. And these messages are constant, so they're on television the whole time, whereas in Serbia, that isn't the case. Maybe Pančevo and Bor people are aware of those local issues, but they're not aware of the environment as a global issue.
And does that then make it harder for NGOs and for a kind of green substance? Yes.
It's not a problem of awareness. It's maybe the hierarchy of the priorities. They know that dangerous air or toxins in the air are harmful. But yes, you can die from benzene or I don't know other chemical in not 10 years. But if you don't have anything to eat, you will die tomorrow. And that's the simplification, but that's the very core of the problem. Yes, maybe I'll die because of cancer or some toxin, but if I don't have a job or some salary or income, that is more dangerous for me, and that is the logic.
But then there's interesting legacies from Central Europe in terms of GMO campaigns. That could be framed and a kind of narrative constructed that actually. This is a threat to a kind of agriculture and a purity and ways of farming that are almost kind of part of a heritage. And do you want to respond to Liliana's point about before we open this?
Incentives.
Incentives.
Yeah, well, let me first come to this question on education, if you don't mind. Yes, I do think there's an information deficit, but I wouldn't say it's only in the general population. I think the first target is the ministries of economy, the ministries of development. I think that's really the place where the argument needs to be made, because those are the key decision makers in countries.
That's sort of what I was hoping.
Okay, well, but I would also say that there is a role for environmental education, and this is actually another thing that the REC does quite well. They have a product called the Green Pack that they work with ministries of education to put into the schools. So I think you need both, but I would target first the ministries of economy and ministries of development. Now, concerning incentives, well, I think, as I said before, I think we're still learning in the EU. We certainly are not on a sustainable green economy path ourselves at the moment. So it's a little hard to say exactly what should be done. I think, as you say, there's an awful lot of thinking going on in international organizations. I think probably OECD are the ones who are trying to frame it the best. The Commission is in the process. The Commission put out what they called a paper on the resource efficiency initiative under EU 2020, but our DG is actually working at the moment on a roadmap that should identify a number of concrete areas where there should be developments to move towards greater resource efficiency, which is closely related to green economy. There are some internal squabbles in the Commission going on about exactly what the scope of the paper should be. It probably won't come out until September. It was originally supposed to be for June.
Do you want to respond to any of these comments?
No, I must confess that not really being a specialist on the environment, I wouldn't want to show myself up, so I'll probably leave the experts.
Okay. Before I have your response, Simona's been waiting very patiently.
I think Anne has just addressed something that I want to raise, the fact that there's very little interministerial cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
In all throughout Central and Eastern Europe, even now after accession, there's all the interministerial working groups are simply not working, and they haven't been working since the beginning. So, yeah, sectoral integration is an issue. That was what I wanted.
And then, a comment from Indranil, you wanted to?
Just a quick comment. We've been talking about capacity building for society. You mentioned REC does some local government, intergovernmental developments, capacity building as well. What other programs are there on the governmental side? We talked about the civil society side, but
mm-hmm.
what about
mm-hmm.
the top-down side of creating shadow hierarchy?
Yeah. Well, I can...
Jan, let Jan go to respond to some of these.
There is a lot, by the way. I mean, this is IAEA does it on nuclear regulators, for instance. I mean, all these different
mm-hmm.
institutions have their capacity building programs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're more formal, sometimes they're more informal. And what I wanted to stress with G10 was don't forget to look at the informal capacity building, because I think that is 90%
mm-hmm.
as important, nine times as important as the rest. The formal ones are only a first step. The informal ones, while things are happening, are a lot more important. You mentioned the ministries of economy, yes. And what I see now happening in environmental assessments, strategic environmental assessments, is that we force ministries of economy
mm-hmm.
to look beyond their only economical viewpoint. with again this demand for alternatives and for alternative scenarios. And my big problem is that the environmental movement so far has always been focusing on environmental ministries. And it's also one of my tasks very often to get them towards the other ministries, and I'm more fighting with economy ministries because I'm working on energy. Energy is very often out of that region. But if you look at incentives, there is one country where at this moment, I think, if I look at energy, the debate is really very rational, very deep, and leads to very interesting conclusions. And nobody will be surprised if I say that's Germany. Now, why did it happen in Germany? In the 1990s, mid-1990s, the German parliament developed 15 different scenarios. It was the first time that happened. Backcasting scenarios, you mentioned it, somebody here mentioned it before. Backcasting scenarios. That formed the basis for the first decision to get out of nuclear power. It was not getting out of nuclear power, it was to go for a renewable energy future. Now we're redoing that again, and you're playing a big role in that, in the Ethics Commission, to discuss certain of those paragraphs there as well. But it is, Germany indeed looked at those different things. And what do you see? An economy that still has a growth factor, whereas everybody else went down. Yes, that has a reason, because the incentive is economic growth. Environmental education, has been a focus, by the way, of very many programs in the start or in the 1990s, especially in Western Balkans and Southeast Europe. And I dread it. I think they're partly they're brilliant. The ecocentric two slides build up on environmental education, and they're part of my heroes. But too many groups got the packs from the rack, et cetera, and got stuck in environmental education. If you want to go over environmental education, you've got to wait for 20 years for the results. That's when those kids get into the ruling room thing. The important thing is that you do environmental education and yes. For the Western Balkans, that is where we felt as groups, SECOR, sometimes very lonely.
I think it's easy to sort of forget aspects of that literature on environmental, but also social movement development in Central Eastern Europe. And I think of the work of people like Helena Flam, who talked about the importance of network entrepreneurs and the critical run. And somebody, I think, mentioned the role of young lawyers. I think which I do, I think is absolutely critical.
You mentioned these entrepreneurs, and that's for me very important, because if I look at the reality on the ground, and I do not look at government programs, but at the reality, I see a huge investment going on in renewable energy in Romania and Bulgaria. First of all, it's because people started to lose the belief that nuclear power would save their problems, because it's not coming in the coming years. So the investors have started to invest again. But it's against the national programs. Yes, they have the renewable energy directive, of course, behind them, but they're going beyond that, I think, in Romania, in the end, in 2020, if things go on.
That's
because of entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Yes.
But that wouldn't have started without the renewable energy directive, because the grid was simply saying, we don't have capacity, we don't have capacity. So, no small investment. If you're a big investor, if you're Enel Power, and you can invest in renewable, you can invest in whatever you want in Bulgaria and Romania. If you're a small hydro, small investor, you couldn't do that because the grid would not buy from you. And now they're buying it because there's this regulation. And so the regulation has outperformed itself because there are economic reasons to do it. But without a regulatory framework providing the incentive factor and equalizing things, it wouldn't have happened.
So everything's coming from the regulation.
There's a clear link between regulation.
Maybe in the energy sector it does come from the regulation, but I think, and we haven't talked about it much today, I think that foreign industry, European industry, does have a very important role in driving change. And I saw it in Romania in the car industry. It was German industry which went into Romania and introduced new standards in the production process. And then that upped the criteria for the local producers and local companies too. So I think that shouldn't be underestimated. It has an impact both on the internal climate, but it also makes the local producers aware of what the European standards are and what they need to meet if they want to export to the EU. So I think that's an important factor. But coming back, I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of SEA and EIA. You mentioned Aarhus, but in fact, I mean, in the context of EU legislations, it's EIA and SEA. And they're certainly two of the key directives that we push on the countries, we being DG Environment, but I mean, I very firmly believe that these directives, even though they're under environment, they're really instruments for democracy promotion.
Yes,
and they're fundamental instruments for good governance, to enable a government and a society to make good choices for their future. But I wanted to answer the question about other kind of capacity building that's going on. Obviously, we have the Commission and all the other donors have bilateral programs with the individual countries. Under the IPA instrument, we do both capacity building and we do infrastructure development. And something that wasn't mentioned at any point today is, of course, under IPA, the potential candidates do not have access to the infrastructure envelope. And that's something that is quite different from what happened in the CEE, because in the CEE, from quite early on, all of the countries became candidates, and so they were able to access money for infrastructure. In the SEE, the countries that do not have candidate status can only get very small amounts of money for infrastructure, or they can get loans, of course, through the banks, but they don't have access to these big pots of money that the CEE countries had.
Could we have an EIU?
Okay, I just want to mention, in addition to the national activities, we do work with the enlargement countries as a group, and we've established an initiative, a network, whatever you want to call it, called RENA. Some of you in the past may have known about the REREP network. RENA is the successor to it, and it's an initiative to help the countries learn from us, but also to learn from one another, and we try to bring in some of the CEE countries, particularly Bulgaria and Romania, to give examples. And we work both on strategic investments and planning, climate change, cross-border cooperation, and also this working group on environmental compliance and enforcement. So we're doing this with all of the countries as a group. I can give you a reference if you want.
Thanks. Let's just try and get this. We've not. Time is running out. Let's.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if this is an EIU view, but it's my personal view. But the first point I'd like to make in response to what you said, Anne, earlier about the importance of directing attention to ministries of economy is that, recalling what was said this morning about, say, Bosnia, for example, the situation in some of the weak states or countries that may be queuing up to become, perhaps once again, failed states, I don't know. It may not be necessarily the best way of dealing with that, because you may not even know which particular ministry to go to, or which authority, or they haven't got the... I'm not trying to generalize, so that is related to a relatively small number of countries that they can look. In terms of, which I mentioned Bosnia this morning, to some extent Albania, Kosovo, of course, who knows. So, I'm not trying in any way to...
We know who to go to. We know who to go to. They may not want to talk to us, but we know who they are.
Can I just...
Or indeed, we'll be able to carry out what governments should enforce and implement policy. But on a more positive note, in what governments, what can be done, what should be done, what should the process of the organization involve? And this is not my view or the EIU's view. This is a policy. Comes from a research document that was published recently by the EBRD, which is talking about the need to extend emissions trading, the EU's emissions trading, carbon dioxide emissions trading to obviously Southeastern Europe, but also the rest of the region beyond. That, of course, raises all sorts of issues about the effectiveness, which some people may the question of emissions trading, because of course it does involve, among other things, in a sense, exporting some of the emissions to countries where it's cheaper to make some minor or relatively small adjustments, but you can offload your emissions, or at least your targets somewhere else. The other problem, of course, would involve enforcement, implementation, again, in countries. We've seen the problems with European emissions trading. Problem, fraud, wrong targets, all that. What happens when it's extended to countries where, again, a weak state, lack of capacity, and so on is involved? And that, of course, opens up the whole issue to something which is not an EU issue, which is to do with taxation, whether in fact the pollutant-based principle, the idea of pollution taxes, should in fact become carbon tax in particular, should become part of the general approach to how you deal.
Thank you. Just conscious, I want to sort of begin to wind things up. Being rather arrogant, I'm just going to push this lastly. There's one other issue which I think was so important in particularly Chris Parrow's paper this morning and her presentation this morning and her paper that she delivered. But also in certain things that came out of this morning's discussion, and that is this issue of, are we overstating the EU's, not just its influence, but its potential impact in this region? And I mean, Chris introduced this notion of a kind of alternative transnational network, so a kind of alternative sources, not just of positive knowledge, if you like, or an alternative positive epistemic community, but an attempt of a network that might actually subvert compliance and actually distract. And I just would like to I know we haven't got a huge amount of time, but I just want to sort of gather any sort of comments or views on that. This idea of we sit here and we think, well, okay, we talk about the limited impact of the EU as though that's some kind of failing of the region, that the region aren't making enough taking enough value or making enough of the EU's role. But actually, do we perhaps need to look carefully at whether the EU actually is so empowered, and who else, if it's not the EU, which other actors are critical? So just some comments. Yes, I'll take some from the floor, then I'll ask the panelists to just
wind up. One problem perhaps is the undermining of existing capacities, because this whole idea of capacity building starts like we are zero, nothing, but there are very effective ways of managing things. Maybe they're not that seen as good, but they're still very effective. For example, again, I'm going to back to fungible case, where environment became very important in certain in short period of time, where when it was used for the pre-election purposes to mobilize people. I will explain shortly. The mayor of Pančevo was from one political option, while the ruling party was from level of Serbia was from the other political option, and also the major polluter, this industry complex, was the same as the government, state government, wanting to help. His option to win the state elections, Mayor of Pančevo organized this a series of environmental protests, and what he used, he brought the protocol, he decided to brought some kind of protocol or regulation, and he decided when this amount of dangerous toxins are in the air, we will put the alarm for chemical danger. And this will make this a huge problem, and everybody will look to Pančevo and to see how this mayor or his option is good, helping people to deal with pollution, and this will help also to win his option to win the state elections. And this was very effective, and actually it was the only factor of winning the elections on the state level, but it was highly appreciated and for this period of time was in focus, and they won elections.
So a sort of domestic agency that's separate from... Yeah.
Okay.
Let's just take any more comments before I ask the panel to... Anybody else would like to comment? Particularly on this, the EU's role and this alternative... Yes, Patel?
Just to...
At last, good.
One
you have to introduce yourself, because you haven't spoken all day.
And just taking your suggestion to a bit of extreme, I'd like to raise the example of Ruzsa Gyula's research of Hungarian socialist and waste management policies, in which, and you know, she researched a period of 1945 to 2005, including the Europeanization period up until Hungary's accession to the EU. And she showed how detrimental the Europeanization waste management policy in Hungary was. And Hungary was a country without a single incinerator during the socialist. And one effect of Europeanization and adopting EU regulation of waste management was an influx of incineration, you know, a business opportunity, export of European high technology to a backward country. That was one point. Second was, you know, she shows how socialist waste management policy in Hungary and in other countries, of course, was perfectly in tune with ecological modernization, which is an approach promoted by the EU nominally. It was all destroyed as a result of the arrival of
and consumer goods that people wanted, because I'm standing against you there. If you say what I see is the things that you mentioned would happen anyway. The fact that I see corruption putting its ugly head up in Bulgaria every now and then is because it's still very deeply ingrained there. The fact that you see undermining going on in Romania or in the Czech Republic, where I see it at the moment far too often. Far more often than 10 years ago, is because it was still there. That generation is still there. That mindset is still there. It will not go away. What I see is with this Europeanization is that we are more aware of it and that we've got some tools to stand up against it, which we did not have before 89. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. Then it was just the party that could create the corrupt atmosphere. So we've got Klaus 3 more years, yeah, but he'll be voted out. I mean, he
okay,
can't stand
it. Okay, let's just final comments. Ben, do you want to make a
okay, well, just broadening the discussion again beyond the environmental realm, which is something that I don't really work from directly. In general terms, what drives progress, I think one word we haven't heard too much about is innovation, and that's something that we try and work with a lot to promote in civil society, particularly in the region. One of the main areas in which that's relevant is financial sustainability. So in terms of the role of the EU, I think that in many ways it might benefit from taking a step back, at least in terms of engaging with civil society, because through this obsession with project funding, it creates donor dependency. NGOs fail to see beyond the next call for proposals, and they don't have to think creatively about ways that they can manage their funds in a different way. So, for example, street fundraising and even social enterprise, two major forms of income for NGOs in many parts of the world. But in the Balkans, they think, oh no, that's never going to work here, and actually, what's the point when we can just wait for another call? Now, that's not to say that there's such a surplus of money sloshing around for project proposals, but it's the easy option. And of course, there are always going to be exceptions to the rule. There are a significant minority of very innovative organisations in the region. Mosaic in Bosnia-Herzegovina stands out, as the Smart Collective in Belgrade, for example, that are pushing things like CSR and relations with corporations as new ways forward. But essentially, by promoting this kind of business-as-usual approach, as the EU does with the project funding, it really stifles innovation rather than encouraging independence.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Maybe to come back sort of on the point that were raised about whether we're squashing good local initiatives and also on the role of the other transnational networks. I mean, obviously it is not appropriate if we go in and dampen down the enthusiasm that actors already have in the region, and certainly we're doing something wrong if we go in and we find people who have taken progressive steps forward and then they feel like they're not doing anything. We're doing something wrong if we're doing that. On the other hand, yes, there certainly can be negative impacts from the acquis, but there we have a little less margin of maneuver. The acquis is what it is. You can debate whether it's correct or not. You can discuss whether or not a directive should be amended, but the rules of the game in enlargement are that the country should accept the acquis as it is, with all its blemishes as well as its benefits. And the acquis does have a lot of very rigid requirements, and it's a huge job to implement. Now, sometimes there will be good things that are being done by other people, but they don't exactly fit the acquis. So that the question is how to build on the motivation, the capacities that exist, and gently, softly nudge them in the right direction. But I think part of the difficulty is because there is so much to be done and the capacities are so weak that there's not always the time for reflection about how to make best use of existing capacities, rather to come in with a whole new program. And unfortunately, what we see happening, and you're asking about other transnational networks, is yes, indeed, there are lots of other actors, and they're actors that are not necessarily linked to the EU acquis. We see UN agencies, loose initiatives, and I would refer to Environment for Europe, which in the past did useful things, but which is our bête noire at the moment, because it's distracting energy, effort, and attention from what we as the EU would like to see happen in the countries. There are the IFIs, there are the non-EU donors. All these people are queuing out up outside the doors of these five people in the Ministry of Environment who at the same time are supposed to be transposing, implementing, and enforcing the acquis. And God help us, after that, all the researchers come in and want to talk to them too. So
shame on us, eh? Well, it seems like a very good point. Thank you very much.
We need to coordinate better, and certainly what we try to do is to work with all these other actors. And we talk, for instance, to USAID, which they have absolutely nothing to do with the EU acquis, but saying, look, you know, the priority of this country is moving towards the EU, so why don't you work with us to try to get this environment up here?
Look, I'd just like to thank the panelists, our practitioners, and the audience very much. But big round of applause to the panelists and practitioners. Thanks. Although we've lost a few people along the way, I think I hope I'm not exaggerating when I say it's been a very enjoyable workshop. I think we've addressed, if not answered, but as academics we never answer questions, we just pose more and more. But I think we've addressed many issues, now in a moment we'll hear the wonderful sound of wine bottles opening and a chink of glass. So please do stay, and we're drinking courtesy of Routledge, which is great news. So, okay, thank you very much indeed. Oh, the clock.
There you go. Okay, that's cool.